It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at a lethal disease that's been affecting bats around the country and has now been confirmed here in Wisconsin. A DNR wildlife expert tells us what it means and what can be done to slow the spread of white nose syndrome.
Today, we continue our discussion about the latest from the Wisconsin Survey from Wisconsin Public Radio and the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute with a look at how the issue of minimum wage is seen in the state, and we'll continue to explore the Wisconsin survey results tomorrow here on Central Time.
Now we're joined by Wendy Scattergood, Assistant Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College and Associate of the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute. In just a bit, we'll continue on with Kevin Quinn, Professor of Economics and Associate Academic Dean at St. Norbert College. Wendy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what put the minimum wage issue on the radar for the survey this time?
Well, it was in the news. They were talking about raising it up potentially to the $10.10 an hour at the federal level. And so we decided to put that back on the radar. We hadn't really asked that question in years and years, actually.
You asked two questions. First, you asked if people supported raising it, the minimum wage in Wisconsin, to $10.10. What did you hear from people?
57%, so the majority, said that they favored that, while 39% opposed and 4% weren't sure. And as you can imagine, there's some partisan differences there, some pretty big ones. Among Democrats, 86% favor. Among independents, 60% favor. And only 30% of Republicans favored raising it to $10.10 an hour.
Then you came at it from a different angle. You said the current minimum wage is $7.25. Would you be in favor of raising it from that level? What did you see in that result?
Right. And it's much higher here. We find 75% overall think that it should be increased above $7.25. And then again, with the partisan breakdown, 96% of Democrats think it should be raised. 54% of Republicans, so a majority, think it should be raised above $7.25, and 81% of independents.
So at least some bipartisan support for some kind of increase in a minimum wage.
Right. So there is obviously then some drop-off between somewhere in between the $7.25, but not getting quite toward $10.10. So if you look at those who think we should increase it above $7.25 of Democrats, 89% also think that it should go all the way up to $10.10. So there's not a lot of drop off there. Among independents, same. For those who want an increase from $7.25 an hour, 74% also said they want it to go up to $10.10. The difference is in Republicans, but it's still a majority, and that is those who think we should increase it above $7.25, still 55% think it should be at $10.10.
On a related note, the survey found that jobs and the economy were the top issues in the state and the nation for Wisconsin respondents. What kind of things are we hearing from people on those issues?
Mm-hmm. Well, there were a number of people at the national level who were talking about the lack of jobs for middle-income folks, lack of high-paying jobs, and also in there were people who were worried about jobs being sent overseas. At the state level, we saw a similar thing with regard to the lack of high-paying jobs, but then also some more concern with either not attracting jobs to Wisconsin or that we're not keeping them here in Wisconsin, that they're going to other states.
Wendy, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks.
That's Wendy Scattergood, Assistant Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. She works with the Wisconsin Survey, and you'll hear her again tomorrow morning at 7 on the Joy Cardine Show, and again with us to introduce marijuana legalization responses on this year's Wisconsin Survey. Now we welcome Kevin Quinn. He's Professor of Economics and Associate Academic Dean at St. Norbert College. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Well, what do you make of this? People in large measure support some kind of minimum wage increase.
Yes, there don't seem to be that many issues in the political world that enjoy that kind of support across the parties. Of course, as Wendy said, there are differences. Democrats overwhelmingly are in favor of it. 96% is pretty amazing for increasing the minimum wage. But I think it just recognizes that that the real value of the minimum wage has been in decline for quite a long time. The $7.25 minimum wage that we have now if you kind of go apples to apples and account for inflation, back in February of 1968, the minimum wage was $10.69 or about $10.70, about close to what they're talking about right now. So essentially what we're talking about is a return to the late 1960s, the high point in terms of the purchasing power of the minimum wage.
Well,
the other thing I would add is that the minimum wage now represents just a slightly over a third of the percentage of average hourly earnings here in the U.S., and that's been in decline for many decades as well. So the minimum wage is quite a modest rule by comparison to where it was in the past.
Well, this has been a big political issue. Democrats in Wisconsin are calling for a special session for, among other things, an increase in the minimum wage. As the minority party, they probably won't get that. Meanwhile, President Obama has been making the case. He's instituted a higher minimum wage for federal contractors, wants Congress to pass a national law. I want to hear the pros and cons from the economic side. What do critics in the economics world say against a minimum wage increase?
Well, the argument against the minimum wage is a very similar argument against over-regulating free markets. If we go back to our Econ 101 and we think about demand curves sloping down and supply curves sloping up, markets, when they work as they should, will find a price or a wage where the quantity supplied is equal to quantity demanded. If we were to set a floor on the price that it couldn't go below, what would happen is price that was too high, at the wage that was too high, there'd be more people looking for work than there would be businesses willing to offer jobs, and that's essentially the definition of unemployment, people that would like to work for the prevailing wage but are unable to find work. And so a very uncritical way of analyzing that gives you, well, minimum wages cause unemployment. The problem with that is that that's been kind of tricky to find actual real-world evidence that increases in minimum wages do much in terms of creating more unemployment. A couple of professors at Princeton in the 90s, 80s and 90s, did some extensive work looking at differences in state minimum wages right on state lines, in this case, Pennsylvania and New Jersey, when New Jersey raised their minimum wage, and found that that increase was not associated with drops in employment. Now, there are some issues there. Some people have argued, I think weakly, that they're terrible methodological issues. But the bottom line is that if this were such a clear-cut slam dunk that increases in minimum wages, at least around the increases that we've seen in the past, that caused unemployment, we should be getting a clear signal in the empirical data. We just don't see that.
But it seems logical. If I'm a small business owner, I'm made to pay my workers more. I might not be able to employ as many people. It might limit my ability to expand my business.
This is true. However, while most businesses are small businesses, most employment is not done by small businesses. If I owned a smaller business, I wouldn't want to be mandated to hire additional people. But there's a supply side issue, too, I think, that people have not paid a lot of attention to. One of the things that we've noticed is that there's been declines in the labor force participation rate. Now, some of that is demographic. We have an older workforce. It's some other things going on. But I suspect part of it is that people who are lightly skilled are facing such low rewards for entering the workforce, I think maybe they stay out. So it's sort of the argument that was made a little while ago about the healthcare stuff, the healthcare reform was going to lose jobs because all of a sudden people didn't need to work as much. And it's kind of the same thing here, is that by lowering the rewards to, or by raising the rewards to work here, you're likely to find that employment the desire to be employed will go up, which may offset some of the employment losses associated with higher prices.
We're talking about the latest results of the Wisconsin survey from Wisconsin Public Radio and the St. Norbert College Strategic Research Institute. Right now, we're finding out what Wisconsin thinks about the minimum wage issue, and we've got Kevin Quinn with us. He's an economist at St. Norbert College.
And we'd like to hear what you've got to say about this. Do you think Wisconsin should raise the minimum wage? And if so, how much would you like to see it raised? If not, why not? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's go right to the phones. We've got Bob on the line in Hayward. Bob, hi.
Oh, hello. Good afternoon. Good subject. I'm against the increase of minimum wage for a couple reasons. One, I believe in a free market economy, i.e. individuals, you and me making the decision of where that price needs to be. But if you look at Switzerland, it's got the highest earning income in the developed world, and they do not have a minimum wage in that country, actually the only one in Europe, but yet they have the highest salary and wages. That's one. Two, when you raise the minimum wage, it hurts minorities the worst, because most that's the highest percent of probably unskilled labor, and it really doesn't give them the opportunity to enter the market. Just how Davis Bacon years ago affected, you can have a direct line between minority unemployment and Davis Bacon wages.
All right, Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Kevin Quinn, I want to bring you in on this. The people hurt most by an increase in the minimum wage are people who are having a tough time getting jobs anyway. That this raises the barrier to entry for them in a way.
I think that has been the sort of the standard Econ 101 argument, and I'm not familiar with the study that he references, but most of the work that I have seen suggests that the signal that's in the actual world when we see this, it just isn't there. The other issue I would say is that if Switzerland doesn't have a minimum wage, but to compare what their skill levels in their economy are, et cetera, what their prevailing wage rates are, what the purchasing power, of course, of that is, putting that aside, if it's a high wage economy, they really don't. But in real life, wages are not really determined in, what we think of as being perfect markets. When we have perfect markets, we have perfect information. There's no barriers to entry. There's no transactions cost. There's no things that prevent somebody from going from one place to another. A lot of labor markets are, in fact, local. So the conditions that need to prevail in order to have markets function very well are weak at best, I think, in labor markets.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Amanda with us in Dodgeville. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. I was wondering what sort of effect having maybe three different minimum wage classes for different age groups, such as around $7 for high school students, $8 or $9 for college students, and then $11 or above for adults. Because a high school student doesn't need to make $11 an hour to survive.
Amanda, thanks a lot for the call. I think I've seen that idea floated and maybe done in some states, Kevin. Is that a popular concept?
Yeah, the idea of a training wage, minimum wage, that's lower has some appeal. I think the primary argument against it more than anything else is the difficulty in trying to administer it. And there are folks that do say that, if you take a college kid who might be pretty bright, they don't have their degree, they don't have a ton of experience, but that might be a better deal at $8 an hour than someone who's 30 years old that has maybe some more experience, but maybe hasn't had the work history that they should, or maybe they're not as naturally gifted. So I think the argument against the argument against a training wage because it might hurt those with the higher wage actually has more currency than the blanket minimum wage. But I think the idea does have merit, and many economists have espoused it.
Amanda, thanks for bringing that up. We'll go to Kathy over in Rice Lake now. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. I was in favor of the minimum wage going to $10 or above. And just as Amanda was saying, she wanted different increments for the different age levels. And I think a blanket minimum wage would be fine because kids, when they're that age, starting in high school and so forth, they're always saving up, or if they're in a position, they can help the family out. But my statement was in wondering, when people are going to be making more money with the increased minimum wage, of course that's going to be more taxes, taken out, and that would make more revenue, of course, for the state or the federal. And also with that. I forgot I was going to say, but
we'll leave it there then, Kathy. Thanks. So she sees a positive impact of people at the minimum wage having more money to work with and maybe more taxes going into state and federal governments.
I have to sort of now argue the other side of it, that the empirical data just don't seem to support that much of an impact when the minimum wage goes up. And it doesn't support the argument that, the sun falls from the sky. It also doesn't support the argument that things get a whole lot better. It'd be nice if we could have all the good without the bad, but it just, at least in the ranges at which we have changed minimum wages in the past, it just doesn't seem to have much of a toehold. Now, maybe that's because what's happening is that the environment in which the minimum wage can go up is one in which it really is not going to affect that many people in the first place, and that's why it has political traction. Now, an increase from $7 to $10 probably would be a little bit higher than what we've seen in the past, so we may see some of the negative effects on unemployment. We may see some of the positive effects on spending and income, but I just don't think that there is a ton there that suggests that we're going to get massive shifts as a result of the change.
This has come up a lot in the context of income inequality in the United States. Is that a possible benefit of a minimum wage increase, bringing both ends closer together, or is that maybe an overpromising of the impact of a minimum wage increase?
Well, I mean, to the extent that it does do anything, I do believe it probably has a slight positive effect on the bottom end. I'm not sure it has much of an effect on the top end. But, you know, that notwithstanding, there's of course, the perception issue as much as anything else. One of the things that I actually have become increasingly concerned about is the degree of income inequality in the U.S., and not so much because it's a political issue, but rather because growing income inequality in, you know, any measure you have indicates that that's the case, can lead to political issues and in instability. And I suspect that, that some of this stuff that you're seeing in response to, you know, the kind of the strong support we're seeing for increases in the minimum wage are probably drawn from that, from the public perception, which is accurate, that income inequality has increased.
Back to our callers now with Patrick in Greenfield. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to allude to the fact that last night on Ed Schultz's show, they had a study, and I wish I could recall by whom, but this group studied the state of Ohio and workers at Walmart in particular, because Walmart is the most profitable corporation in America. And 15% of the Walmart workers are on public subsistence, so that because they're under the poverty line. Now, those people are taking money out of the taxpayers' pocket, and they have to do so in order to survive. Yet Walmart, which is so profitable, if they were to take and raise their workers up so that they're above the poverty line, which the average is $8.86 an hour, and they're actually above minimum wage levels now, but they're still below the poverty line, if they got a 10-10 base salary, that would take all of them out of poverty. They would no longer need public assistance. And the net effect to Walmart, they looked at a cost of a box of macaroni, which is 86 cents now, and it would go up one penny. So,
gotcha. I want to give Kevin Quinn a chance to weigh in on that before we're done. That last point, raising the minimum wage, he says, wouldn't raise our costs at a store that had to pay its workers more?
Well, I mean, I didn't see that study. I've heard this argument made with Walmart before. Unfortunately, it's hard for me to kind of weigh in on the veracity of that or particular study or others like it, because they tend to be done for and by folks who already kind of know what the conclusion is going to be. And by the way, that's true for the other side of the aisle as well. I mean, there would be probably some impact on Walmart, but you know, Walmart's ability to price is not universal. I mean, they don't just get to decide that they're going to charge, you know, 50 cents for a box of macaroni or a dollar for a box of macaroni. They have to be reflective of what the marketplace looks like as well. In many of the marketplaces they're in, they do have some pricing power, but not vast. So my guess is that the extent to which it would be costly, it probably would affect Walmart's bottom line to a non-trivial degree. Now, whether or not that would cause the economy to crash down, I think it probably wouldn't.
We'll leave it there, Kevin. Thanks for joining us.
Great. Thank you very much.
That's Kevin Quinn, professor of economics and associate academic dean at St. Norbert College.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Spring Green was voted one of the top small towns in the U.S. to visit in 2014. Jim DeVita of the American Players Theater will share why he chose to settle down there.
First, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources announced today some devastating news for the state's bat population and for all of us who rely on these bats to be part of the ecosystem.
A case of white nose syndrome has officially been confirmed in Wisconsin. The DNR says the disease has already been confirmed in 23 other states and estimates that it's killed nearly 5 million bats since 2006. That's causing some serious environmental and economic consequences.
Joining us now to talk more about this is Aaron Crane, who leads the DNR Natural Heritage Conservation Program. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica.
Well, can you fill us in? What is the latest news about white nose syndrome found here in Wisconsin?
Well, part of our regular annual winter surveillance for the disease, we found it late in our surveillance season. We usually go through the entire state at the beginning of the winter season, and then a second time we do a follow-up at some of the sites to make sure that we haven't missed anything. And we found the positive in Grand County just last week. It was at a surveillance site that we found on March 28th.
Was this bad news that you knew was coming, or was it something that you've been expecting?
Well, we knew that it would get here eventually, and Wisconsin has been very proactive in trying to put as many measures in place as possible to slow the spread and keep it from our borders, basically. But we have, you know, it began in the eastern part of the United States and has moved slowly across the country. We knew it was coming, and we knew that there's only certain things that we can control, which is the human transmission of it. But the major transmission of the disease is bat-to-bat.
Well, we've been hearing about this, as you said, for a long time. It's been out on the East Coast, I know, initially. What exactly is white nose syndrome, and what does it do to the bats?
So white nose syndrome is actually it is a result of a fungus, and the fungus is not a native fungus to the United States. It came over from Europe, and consequently our bats weren't immune to the effects of it, but the fungus will cover the bats during their hibernation time, and the fungus is more active under humid and cool conditions. So when they're hibernating, that's what those conditions are like, and the fungus itself doesn't kill the bats. What happens is bats are designed to hibernate for a long period of time during the winter, and what the fungus does, it irritates the bats. The bats wake up continually grooming themselves, trying to get rid of the fungus. And in doing so, they use up all of their fat stores so that they can't make it through their hibernation season, or they leave prematurely from the hibernation site out into the winter where they'll die on the landscape.
Now, I understand the DNR is still waiting for test results from other sites. You mentioned the one positive in Grand County. Is there reason right now to believe that's already spread to other parts of Wisconsin?
Not at this point, actually. And the reason being is that we send our results into the Wildlife Health Lab, as do many states. And there's kind of a priority order in which they take a look at those samples. And so when our crew had found visual signs of white nose at this particular site, when they got into contact with the Wildlife Health Lab, they said, these are visual signs. We've seen visual signs as well. And that put that sample right up at the top of the list to get done. So we got the results back quickly. So the fact that we haven't gotten the other results back doesn't mean that we don't have it, but if it was something that was more likely to be a positive, we would have gotten those results back earlier.
How big a place for bats is Wisconsin? How many colonies are there?
Well, the ones that we know of, we have well over 100, and Wisconsin is a little different than some of the other states in that the majority of our hibernacula are, or hibernation sites, are mines, not caves. We have much fewer caves than we do man-made mines, but the bats do use those. And actually, Wisconsin is the home to some of the largest winter hibernating sites in the upper Midwest. So we have historically, we've had a very comparatively large and healthy bat population.
So it sounds like Wisconsin is pretty huge as far as bat populations. How devastating do you expect white nose to be in Wisconsin now that it's gotten here?
Well, it takes a couple of years before you see the mortality rate. Usually in the first year, it's very low, and the second year is when you really see the major die-offs, and then the third year is kind of the end of it, and you see who the survivors are, basically. But the white nose is, you know, the mortality rate associated with white nose is 95%.
Mm.
So it's, you know, in the next several years, theoretically, we'll be losing 95% of our cave bats.
95% of the cave bats. And this mm-hmm. this is a syndrome, a disease that's been around for a while. Has science made any inroads in containing it or minimizing the damage?
There's a lot of research going on across the country, some that Wisconsin is involved in and many of the other states. And the research is looking at all different kinds of ways of trying to stop this spread. So, for example, there was research into human transmission of it. They found that, you know, the fungus can remain dormant on clothing and like caving gear and that sort of thing. And then when it gets in the right conditions, it can start up again. So that's why we had restrictions on decontamination measures that folks needed to use if they were going to be going into caves. And those were at the national level as well. There's research into vaccines. There's research into how to clean the bats so that they can shed the fungus and see if they can get it totally out of their system so that they don't reinfect. There's research going on about changing the environmental conditions of hibernating sites. As I was saying, that there's a relatively narrow set of environmental conditions that the fungus is active in, and so there's research into, you know, dropping the humidity or making it colder or any number of things so that the bats can still use the site, but the fungus doesn't thrive in it. So there's a really concerted effort across the country in trying to address it.
Any chance any of those things will come to fruition before, you know, we lose 95% of the bat population?
Boy, that's a tough call. You know, the research has been going on for quite some time, and there has been some progress, as I said, for example, leading to decontamination measures and things like that. But, you know, it's difficult with an animal that is very very concentrated, so their population is concentrated, and they fly. So it's a little difficult to be able to, it's not like you can. Some of these hibernacula in our state have, you know, over 60,000 bats in one site. It's not like you can go in and, you know, clean all the bats and try to rehab them and let them go. So the biology of the bats make a response kind of difficult as well.
Obviously, the main cause of concern here is mortality to the bats, but does this also mean that we're going to be overrun with mosquitoes in the next 3 years? Bats eat mosquitoes.
Yes, bats eat mosquitoes and a whole lot of other what we would consider pests. And so there's going to be, when you remove not just one species, but four, so we have four cave bat species in Wisconsin that are all susceptible to white nose. If you remove four of the species out of an ecosystem, it makes a big difference. And so I don't know how to quantify that impact, but there will be impacts in the number of pests that are surviving because the bats aren't eating them. I wish I could remember the comparison that we've used over the years. Bats eat a tremendous amount. A single bat can eat a tremendous amount compared to its body weight in a single night of feeding. And it's, I think I have this right, or very close to it. It would be the equivalent of a person eating 25 hamburgers a day. So it's a lot of, they're taking a lot of agricultural and forest and human pests out of the environment. And, you know, we're going to see the impact of that over the years.
Erin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
We've been talking to Erin Crane. She leads the DNR Natural Heritage Conservation Program.
Coming up next, if you're looking for a place to visit this summer, Smithsonian Magazine says, hey, consider Spring Green, Wisconsin. It appears that spring may finally be here, knock on wood, and it's time to start making some summer travel plans.
Well, according to Smithsonian Magazine, before heading out of state, you might want to consider Spring Green, Wisconsin. The magazine voted Spring Green one of the 20 best small towns in the U.S. to visit in 2014. It's home of the American Players Theater and Frank Lloyd Wright's home Taliesin, along with hiking paths and a vibrant music scene.
Here with us to share some of his love for Spring Green is American Players Theater actor Jim DeVita. This season marks his 20th year with the theater. He's also a playwright, the author of two novels, and a former volunteer EMT in Spring Green. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, you're an actor. Usually that draws people to the big city. How did it lead you to Spring Green?
I know. I'm still trying to figure that out today a little bit. I mean, well, it's funny. You know, I was all over the country as a young actor when I first started out. I'm originally from New York City, and but I'm kind of an odd duck, and I've always, quality of life has always been kind of important to me. And even when I was out of school, I was trying to look at some smaller cities like Minneapolis or Seattle, and happened to be in Chicago when I got a job out here, and I came out to Spring Green. And the first thing, you know, I was just attracted to the land out here. The geography is just stunning in the Driftless area, and I'm a fisherman, so we had the Wisconsin River, we had canoeing, and this beautiful land out here, and in the middle of that was American Players Theater, which serves over 100,000 people a year. So it was like this kind of this paradox out here. And it's like, does anybody know this is out here? but I fell in love just with the land at first. That was kind of the first thing before I started getting involved in the community and working out here for a long time.
And the home of architect Frank Lloyd Wright is near Spring Green. What's special about Taliesin?
Well, Taliesin, I mean, for, you know, again, it's what those organizations, the kind of influx of young people and energy that they bring into the town each year. That's true both of American Players Theater and Taliesin. And we often talk about, you know, I'm here for 20 years now. And so when the spring comes around, like both the birds and the animals start coming out, then we also start seeing architects and actors on the streets. And, you know, we saw one today. So it's great kind of energy that they bring into the town every year.
Some of our listeners have probably been to APT. For those who haven't, can you give us a taste? What is special about American Players Theater?
American Players Theater, well, we're a classically based theater. We're an outdoor theater. We also have an indoor space, but we're mainly known for our outdoor theater, which is a 1,200-seat amphitheater under the stars on the top of a hill surrounded by trees. And it's a physically gorgeous place to come and to see a show. But we do both classical work, which is, you know, we always do at least two Shakespeare's every year. We do Moliere, Ibsen, Chekhov, and then we also do some more contemporary plays, particularly now that we have an indoor space which seats 200 people. But the experience of coming here, and we have picnic grounds out here, which most people come out, because it's not everybody just hops out of their car. You usually have to take a drive to get out here. So people plan a little meal, and we have picnic tables, and people usually eat and have a glass of wine, and then the walk up the hill takes about 7 to 10 minutes, depending on how fast you are, to actually get to the theater itself. And the plays happen underneath, you know, under the stars at the end. One of the big traditions is when the lights go out at the end, you know, 1,000 people look up to the sky to see the stars. So it's a wonderful way to experience a play in the outdoors, and I've been doing it for 20 years now, and it's quite enjoyable.
And I understand there's quite a vibrant music scene in Spring Green. For one thing, I've heard that there is a town Bob Dylan Fest day.
Uh-huh. We've got the Dylan Fest down at the General Store where we have a Bob Dylan Day. There's also a Beatles Day, which has been happening at the same place. So we've kind of got a fest for Bob and a fest for the Beatles. And we also have the Shitty Barn, excuse the language, but that's the name of the barn out here, which gets musicians from all over the country, really, really talented musicians that they book in here. So it's part of what's fascinating about this small town, which was, I think, 1,200 people when I started here, and maybe we're up to 1,500 even now. But we have this amazing mix of small town life and also this kind of vibrant art scene, which happens each year. And we have Both music and theater in the architecture school, and we have the arts fair, which is a huge arts fair that we have here every year also.
And you just mentioned the general store. I've never been there, but that's supposedly a great place, a well-known place for people to meet up in Spring Green. What's the general store scene there?
The general store is a general store. It's just like it sounds. It's kind of lovely. It's kind of hardwood floors, and you got great coffee and great breakfast there, and it's become kind of one of the meeting places here when if you don't know where to meet somebody, you say, well, I'll meet you at the general store. And there's only one general store in town. So if you ask anybody in any corner, they'll point you to it. And we've got a couple of other great places. We have kind of a higher-end, very nice restaurant called Freddie Valentine's now. We have The Shed, which is our local bar restaurant. Arcadia, which is another coffee shop bookstore. So there's a few places to meet here, too.
Since you're an actor, I thought we'd ask you, if the town of Spring Green was a character in a Shakespearean play, what character would it be? Hopefully it's not Iago or something like that.
That's very funny. For one of my first, that's a very funny question. I went to some of the comic characters, I think like Dogberry and Much Ado or something, and I mean that, I don't mean, because it's I find the town fun. When I first moved here, I almost equated it to our own little... Do you remember that TV show called Northern Exposure?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like this, to me, a little bit like that, that in a wonderful way, because we have all of us, there's so many different walks of life here, these people out here, and I'm one of them, these people. I'm one of those wonderfully diverse characters that we have here. We have people, you know, the man in the corner in overalls has a PhD in two novels that he's published. Another person is the farmer sitting next to him is an organic farmer, and then there's a sculptor and an architect, and there's a wonderful kind of commingling of very very different diverse backgrounds out here, and it's fun. You never know who you're going to run into or who you're going to meet, and those of us that have moved here over the years have kind of just been welcomed in the community. When I first moving into the community, I kind of was an outsider, but then got involved both in, you know, here in EMT and in the church and stuff like that. And I raised two children here, and you become part of the community, and it's kind of wonderful that way. It's an odd little wonderful town for me, and I mean that in all the best respect.
What was it like being an EMT in this small town? Very different, I imagine, than being an actor.
Yeah, well, it was wonderful, you know, because I'm from a big city. So I remember when I saw a sign for volunteer ambulance, workers and EMTs. I just always thought there always were ambulances. I was from New York. I never even thought that some towns have a volunteer. So it was actually I learned how to be a part of a community, because as an actor, you're an itinerant. You're all over the country. You never put down roots anywhere. So being an EMT, the great kind of the unexpected result, or you know, that I also got from it, other than just the reward of being able to help your neighbors, was running into people I would never run into in my usual line of work. And so I've met people from, every walk of life in this town. And that was great for getting me into the community, too, because I got to come, I'm not just that actor that comes in here for the summers. No, this is a guy that lives here, and he's raising kids. And so it was a wonderful way that put me together with people that I probably never would have met before.
Now, a lot of what we've been talking about today in Spring Green, the theater, for example, Taliesin, it seems like stuff that's best enjoyed in the warmer months. But is Spring Green just a summer town, or can you find stuff to do there any season?
Well, I'm sure you can. And it depends on what you like to do, of course. It does get very quiet here in the winter months, and which some of us, I think, really like. I will speak for myself. I enjoy the winter months when it gets a little quiet. But I'm a writer, too, so I have a very, very busy time 6 months a year, and then it kind of quiets down, and I actually enjoy it at that time of year. But, boy, there's something out here for almost everyone. I'm not sure how deeply into the winter you go, but I fish up until everything ice is over, and then I'm not exactly an ice fisherman, although I've been taken out ice fishing. They are crazy, crazy men and women. But I've done it a few times, and I already started fishing this year already. I get in the water as early in April as I can, so I love fishing out here. And but I say, the hunting and the hiking and the canoeing and lots of camping. A lot of people that come to APT camp around here, too, which is fun. So there's lots of stuff to do out here.
Briefly, I wanted to ask before I let you go, a new season, who are you going to be this year on the stage?
Well, I'm very fortunate. I'm actually directing at the top of the year. I'm directing Romeo and Juliet, which which happened to be, I played Romeo, I can't, how many years ago? Actually, it was 20 years ago. Romeo was the first play I was in at APT. I was in Chicago, and I got offered a job. This is 20 years ago, which brought me out here, and I was much younger, and I was fortunate to be able to play the role of Romeo, and that's the role I was doing when I first met Spring Green. And 20 years later, here I am, and established in the community, I am now directing that show.
That's great. So. Jim, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a lot of fun.
It's great. Thanks for talking with me.
That Spring Green was voted one of the 20 small towns in America to visit in 2014 by Smithsonian Magazine. We've been speaking with actor Jim DeVita and director Jim DeVita of the American Players Theater.